The calls from beyond can come in a thousand forms, so we cannot ignore the effect of psychedelics on the lives of many modern masters. Andrew Weil, the Harvard physician who has studied the use of sacred substances worldwide, writes, "The tradition of most ancient cultures included a positive use of psychoactive medicine, from China to Greece, to India to the Americas. Many who have committed themselves to the spiritual journey had the gates of perception burst open by psychedelic experiences. In truth, the majority of current spiritual teachers in the West have at least in part traveled this route. Much danger lies in the misuse of these substances, and we all know the tragic stories of their abuse, but still, they are a part of our heritage. From Zen beats of the 1950s to the flower children of the 60s and 70s to shamanic journeys of the 80s, many spiritual leaders I encountered spoke of the effect of mind-altering explorations." A renowned Zen teacher, whose psychedelic journeys began her spiritual search, recognized that her initial visionary experiences were not enough. She went to Korea and Japan to look for a Zen master, visited many temples, but no place seemed quite right. Back in Kyoto, the home of Zen, she came up with the idea of taking some LSD and going to the holiest temple of the city. "I was on my way when a force like a huge invisible hand simply stopped me in my tracks. I was amazed. It was as if the gods would not allow me to take another step farther. What could I do? I turned around and went into the temple gates that were just beside me by the side of the road. Inside, there was a small man sitting cross-legged, lecturing in simple English, saying the clearest things I had ever heard about the mind and the heart. It was the next step, just what I was looking for. I put my bags down and stayed for 12 years. Most teachers realized right away that even at their best, psychedelics would prove too limited a path, providing no systematic way to live with an awakened mind and open heart. It seems impossible that there's not a spiritual stream, a current of potential awakening that, when the moment is right, is waiting for each of us. Returning to our home. Many of these stories involve outward travel, but their real subject is finding our spiritual home. The purpose of recounting such exotic and somewhat magical tales is not to compare them with our own. We each have our own unique story, our own call to return. But such accounts can shock our system into remembrance, reminding us that we are each here on a great errand. In time, we must each awaken. Awakening may hide in our attic for years, waiting until we raise our children or finish our business career. But someday it will appear to break down the gate and say, "Ready or not, here I am." Being alive is itself an expression of mystery. The clues to our real nature are always around us. When the mind opens, the body changes, or the heart is touched, all the elements of spiritual life are revealed. Great questioning, unexpected suffering, original innocence, any of these can require us to open beyond our daily routine, to step out of the bureaucracy of ego, as the Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa counseled. Every day brings its own calls back to the spirit. Some small, some large, some surprising, some ordinary. One senior Zen practitioner was a young lawyer and father in 1969 when he encountered the books of Alan Watts on Zen. This piqued his curiosity and his spirit, reminding him there was something more to life. So he looked in the phone book under Z and found a number. In a few minutes, he was talking to the Roshi at San Francisco Zen Center. He got the center's schedule and, with encouragement from the master, began to practice. 30 years later, still avidly practicing, he says, "My life transformed from that first phone call." Even more ordinary is the story told by another meditation master who'd been an avid sportsman 30 years ago. Golf was his favorite sport. As he played, he became aware of how much his mind and spirit determined his game. "I tried to quiet myself, I was shocked to see how agitated and out of control my mind was. A friend suggested I come to her yoga and meditation class, and even though I struggled to sit, it felt like coming home. While the clues are here for us every day, our family and education may have taught us to pretend we don't see. One Jewish woman, now a rabbi, said her family ignored any spiritual teachings. The occasional visits to their Reform temple were mostly about social responsibility and Jewish cooking. So she had to go, as Rilke writes, toward a church in the East that our father forgot. She began seeking her path for 10 years among the Native Americans. Then she was curiously pulled to visit Jerusalem, and she met the wife of an old Hasid, who reminded her of a hidden inheritance of thousands of years of spirit within her own tradition. After visiting the Wailing Wall, the rabbi's wife Miriam took me to her back room. We sat and talked about her grandparents and the holy way they would light their candles, break their bread, raise their children, how every part of their life was governed by the Torah, every act a sacred act. It was so like the Native Americans that I loved, but when she pulled out these thin pages of handwritten, Kabbalistic script, I recognized that I myself was part of this ancient lineage, that the heritage of the spirit ran through my veins as well as my heart. Baba Yaga lives in our own neighborhood as well as in the forest. She is part of our own family history. We can go to India or Jerusalem, and some of the most magical stories of these masters might have us believe that this is the way a spiritual life must begin. But it also begins in a moment of gardening, in the simple act of returning home after a voyage and seeing it fresh, in the touch of an inspired piece of music, a poem's song, the flight of a bird. Every pair of eyes we look into can become the eyes of the beloved. For me, growing up on the East Coast meant the pleasure of seeing fireflies in summer. But my daughter, who was born in California, had never seen one. In our travels, we discovered there were fireflies in the tropical nights of Bali. After she went to bed one night, I tucked in her mosquito net, then went out and caught a few. Her eyes were closed. I put them in her net and whispered for her to wake up. They flew around inside her net until we let them out, and she was totally captivated by their luminous trails in the night. How improbable and fantastic, how unlikely to have beautiful insects with soft blinking lights. And yet this is no more unlikely than our own loving heart. Our hearts shine in the same way as the fireflies, with the same light as the sun and the moon. Within us is a secret longing to remember this light, to step out of time, to feel our true place in this dancing world. It's where we began and where we return. Whether we wait until the last or see it this very day, the call to mystery presents itself again and again to our eyes and our hearts. As Mary Oliver has written, when death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look at everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular, and each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. The Guardians of the Heart, Angels of Light and Oceans of Tears. From Helen Keller. Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of humans as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Once we are called to the inner adventure, we begin following the tracks of the sacred ox in the forest. As we look into the mind or heart, we discover they hold and encompass our whole world. Outwardly, our telescopes reveal the vastness of space, with its myriad galaxies and its birthing stars. Inwardly, we begin to discover the equally vast regions of consciousness out of which all things arise. Some say we should be careful if we choose to follow the tracks of the sacred ox, for the spiritual journey can bring everything in life into question. Some even warn us before we begin. When the Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa arrived late, as usual, to a crowded San Francisco lecture hall, he offered a refund to anyone who did not want to stay. He warned those who were new that a spiritual path is arduous and demanding, involving one insult after another. So he suggested that those with doubts not embark. "If you haven't started, it's best not to begin," he said. Then he looked steadily around the room and continued, "But if you've begun, it is best to finish." An honorable practice. We live in disordered times, complicated, distracted, and demanding. Yet to sustain a spiritual practice demands our steady attention. The first task, then, in almost any spiritual voyage, is to quiet ourselves enough to listen to the voices of our hearts, to listen to that which is beyond our daily affairs. Whether in prayer or meditation, visualization or fasting or song, we need to step out of our usual roles, out of the busy days on automatic pilot. We need to find a way to become receptive and open. To recognize spiritual longing is not enough. The heart needs inspiration for renewal. It needs support to find forgiveness, to awaken freedom, to open to grace. We must find a vessel, an honorable practice, to carry us on this journey, a trustworthy discipline that's able to bring us back to the present, to open us to mystery, not in order to become someone else, to fix ourselves, but in order to see who we really are. Great spiritual traditions offer us 100 good ways to do this. Some practices use the breath to quiet the mind and open the heart. There are meditative disciplines of the body that transcend the grasping of our small self, lead us to openness. There are mantras and rituals of devotion, prayers and rosaries, daily practices of sacred attention. There's the silent inquiry of the heart. In one Native American community, a youth would fast, seeking visions for days, while rolling a small stone around a larger one without pause, like the moon around the earth, until the answer to his quest appeared. While we might initially explore several traditions and practices, in the end, we must choose one practice and follow it with our whole heart. What matters is the sincerity that we bring to the way we have chosen, a perseverance and willingness to stay with it and see what opens within us. A true practice leads us into the silence of the forest. Wherever we begin, we have to stop and listen. There's a story from the time Bill Moyers was press secretary for President Lyndon Johnson. At a White House cabinet lunch, Moyers, who was trained as a minister, was asked to offer the grace. "Speak up, Bill," commanded Johnson. "I can't hear a damn thing." From his end of the table, Moyers answered softly, "I wasn't addressing you, Mr. President." What can we expect as we enter the forest to listen more deeply to the quietest of speech? Whether taken through ritual, prayer, or meditation, the first steps into the forest bring us small amazements and tender revelations. When our heartfelt attention begins to separate the reality of the present from the endless waterfall of our thoughts, the world shines with a brilliant beauty. We also begin to see how much our unnoticed interior states and unrecognized beliefs control our life. We awaken to patterns of emotions and habits. We can sense the conflicts we carry from a larger perspective, from the spacious stream of the practice we have chosen. With each step, we open further. A traditional Swedish story gives a sense of the next phase of this journey. Because of the mishaps of her parents, a young princess named Aris must be betrothed to a fearful dragon. When the king and queen tell her, she becomes frightened for her life. But recovering her wits, she goes out beyond the market to seek a wise woman who's raised 12 children and 29 grandchildren and knows the ways of dragons and men. The wise woman tells Aris that she indeed must marry the dragon, but there are proper ways to approach him. She then gives instructions for the wedding night. In particular, the princess is bidden to wear 10 beautiful gowns, one on top of another. A wedding takes place. The feast is held in the palace, after which the dragon carries the princess off to his bedchamber. When the dragon advances toward his bride, she stops him, saying that she must carefully remove her wedding attire before offering her heart to him. And he too, she adds, instructed by the wise woman, must properly remove his attire. To this the dragon willingly agrees. As I take off each layer of my gown, you must also remove a layer. Then, taking off the first gown, the princess watches as the dragon sheds his outer layer of scaly armor. Though it's painful, the dragon has done this periodically before. But then the princess removes another gown, and then another. Each time, the dragon finds he too must claw off a deeper layer of scales. By the fifth gown, the dragon begins to weep copious tears at the pain, yet the princess continues. With each successive layer, the dragon's skin becomes more tender, and his form softens. He becomes lighter and lighter. When the princess removes her 10th gown, the dragon releases the last vestige of dragon form and emerges as a man, a fine prince whose eyes sparkle like a child's, released at last from the ancient spell of his dragon form. Princess Aris and her new husband are then left to the pleasures of their bridal chamber to fulfill the last advice of the wise woman with 12 children and 29 grandchildren. As in a dream, all the figures in such a story can be found within us. We find the scaly dragon and the attending princess, the wise grandmother, the irresponsible king and queen, the hidden prince, and the unknown one who cast the enchantment long ago. What this story reveals from the start is that the journey is not about going into the light. The forces of our human history and entanglements are tenacious and powerful. The path to inner freedom requires passing through them. Receiving grace, opening to illumination, becoming wise has not been easy even for the masters. It is described as a difficult purification, cleansing, letting go, and stripping away. Suzuki Roshi called it a general house cleaning of the mind. It is painful to cast off our own scales, and the dragons guarding the ways are fierce. It requires the inspiration of angels. It requires diving into the ocean of tears. Sometimes the end of the path shows itself early. It is as if the mystical flirts with us, entices us into the world of the spirit. One meditation teacher remembers it this way. People talk about peak moments. At the end of my very first meditation retreat, well, this was a whole peak day. After a week of great pain and frustration and considerable struggle, on the final day the color of the trees along the road seemed to sparkle with light. My heart was open like the mother of the world. I felt I could embrace the fullness of life, and everything I saw rested in a natural love. It all seemed natural and pure. I knew this was always true, even when I'd forgotten it, and it didn't last, but it inspired my heart to go on. This first beauty is important to remember. But we must also remember the weeks of pain and considerable struggle that went before and the many years of practice that must follow. When we seek to open to the illumination of the divine, even if we know that the prince and princess will succeed in awakening, even if we can actually glimpse the sacred wedding, we cannot just go to the last page of the story and live happily ever after. We have to go through the great fear of marrying the dragon, the seeking of wise counsel, and the long process of releasing the painful habits we've clung to. It is the difficult, slow letting go that allows us to awaken from our own enchantment. Removing the scales of the body. Most people report that their first years of spiritual practice involve uncovering the scales of the dragon. We directly experience these layers in the body, the heart, and the mind. The first scaly layer to be revealed, whether in prayer, meditation, or devotion, is the pattern of tensions we keep in our body. All it takes is sitting quietly for the areas of contraction and holding to become apparent. The tightness in our shoulders or back or jaw or legs reveals itself. For much of our lives, whenever we encounter conflict and stress, we contract in habitual ways, building up what Wilhelm Reich called character armor. Some traditions begin to release the physical holding in the breath and body directly through techniques like yoga, tai chi, or Sufi movement. If these practices are used wisely to free rather than conquer the body, the tensions begin to open naturally and the sense of holding can give way to a new flexibility. But even in traditions without such physical practices, the body layers will show themselves and must be dealt with. In the hours of prayer, meditation, or contemplation, we start to feel pain and tension build. All the holdings of years start to come to the surface. One student remembers, "At first it was my knees that hurt, and I blamed it all on the meditation. But then I felt my neck and shoulders become hot, my back more painful in places it always felt tight. The tension in my body continued to grow. At times it was even hard to breathe deeply. Memories, old pains were surfacing now. It was so unpleasant, I tried to push it away. I even tried to meditate by lying down on the softest pad I could find, hoping the pain would go away. But to my surprise, even lying down, as soon as I really paid attention, all the tension was right there again, waiting for me. I fought with my body for a long time, years. Only when I finally learned to let even the deepest pain be okay and hold it with kindness did it begin to release. Now it comes and goes. What a blessing it was to finally accept my body." Along with the tensions of the body, there also arise layers of restlessness and resistance. This can feel like the struggle to calm down in the midst of a very busy day. At first, we can scarcely stay in our seat. We have so many ideas and responsibilities. We've taken so much of the hectic energy inside us. But the practices of prayer, meditation, or devotion ask for repeated surrender, for perseverance through every form of restlessness and resistance. Fortunately, as the dragon skins are removed, it is not all pain. There also comes a lightness as each wedding gown is removed, as if angels are bringing blessings to alternate with our tears. Moments of spaciousness and wonderful calm can arise, bringing an opening of the senses, a restoration of our heart's innocence. One Christian monk remembers, "In the monastery garden, I was doing a simple walking meditation back and forth, saying a prayer and breathing gently with each step to steady myself. All of a sudden, I was a 2-year-old boy again, taking his first step. It was glorious. Just the pleasure of putting my foot down, the spongy grass, smell of the earth and the roses. All the plants and insects seemed much bigger, like when I was so young. It all felt so alive. I felt I would do anything to stay in touch with this pure heart." Shedding the skins of the heart. As we struggle to open the body, we inevitably encounter the necessity of opening and healing the heart as well. The dragon skins of the heart first appear as the unconscious energies of contraction. The Sufis call these the nafs. The Buddhist and Hindus speak of hindrances to the pure heart. The Christians wrestle with the seven deadly sins, such as lust and pride. All spiritual journeys require that we directly face these energies of grasping, anger, pride, fear, restlessness, and doubt, the habits that keep the heart closed. Initially, we may discover how the heart closes when we're caught in the power of our own grasping. The wanting mind or the neediness in us always wants more than we have now. It tries to use external experience to fill our spiritual need for connection. To release the dragon skins of grasping and wanting, we must first come to know them directly, how they're held in our body and the stories they tell in our mind. We must locate and name our longings, and we must discover that it's possible to release our heart from their entangling thrall. At the other pole, from desire and the wanting mind, we will discover scaly armor that pushes the world away, the anger and judgment that rejects how things are. New practitioners in any discipline are usually shocked by how much judgment, aversion, hatred they discover in themselves. Each time we blame and fight with the world around us, we reject and cut off parts of ourselves. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, whose books on Stalinist Russia have awakened us to the suffering of millions, writes, "If only there were evil people out there, insidiously committing evil deeds, and it was only necessary to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who among us is willing to destroy a piece of their own heart?" Like the dragon, before we can be free to love, we need to touch our own scales and come to terms with our judgmental voices. We will find layers of anger and hatred caused by betrayal and loss. We will find a thousand aversions and resistance to the way things are. Meditative awareness begins to unravel the thought weave of judgment. We discover a critical commentary that continually evaluates us and all those around us, that keeps us in battle with life as it is. One Buddhist teacher says, "I never knew how judgmental I was till I meditated. There was a judgment, an opinion about every little thing, inside and out. Too loud, too soft, not enough, too much. Finally, my own teacher had me count them, hundreds of judgments in an hour. I started to laugh a little when I realized it was so clearly a habit, and I didn't have to take it so seriously. But then the next year, my practice changed, and I hit rage. That was hard. I had used all those judgments to try to be a good boy for so long. I had no idea how much pain and anger were stored in there. For months it came out in feelings, images, thoughts, and in my body." Anger, like the grasping of desire or the tyranny of judgment, is a skin that we can loosen. In the story, the princess and the dragon must reveal themselves layer by layer, and both become more available, more tender. As the first scales and gowns of disguise are peeled away, we begin to learn what is underneath the contraction of anger, judgment, and wanting. Usually, we discover a new layer of hurt, loneliness, fear, and grief. This is where offering a tender heart becomes essential. This is the place of courage, the courage to hold in love the hardest pain, our deepest sorrows, greatest fears. It is here that trust and surrender are nurtured. The awakening of this spirit of mercy and kindness is like the visitation of the angels. There comes an energy to forgive, a new softening and receptivity of the heart. My teacher Ajahn Chah put it like this: "If you haven't wept deeply, you haven't begun to meditate." The grief and sorrow that arise when we begin to open are both personal and universal. Many teachers say they'd not expected such grief to come, but the heart has its own logic. One respected Zen teacher remembers, "After the first several years of flirting with Zen, the time came for me to commit. I signed up for the winter practice period, 3 months of intensive training without a break. My sitting had become quite calm and spacious, and I expected this Zen-like clarity only to grow. But it was not to be. I spent the entire practice period weeping, and wept for half the following winter period as well. I grieved for all the conflict and insecurity of my early years. The hurt of lost relationships, for the ways I'd misused my body, for sorrows, for the death of my father. Only then, after 2 years, did my sitting open to an immense and deep silence. The dragon skin of our unshed tears covers the sadness and longing that connect us with the realm of sorrow in all of life. Sometimes our sorrow is the result of a particular event, the death of a parent, a family history of alcohol or abuse, a major loss in our life. Other times, it's the accumulation of 1,000 moments of being unseen, unrecognized, unheld. An honorable spiritual practice recognizes the losses we have suffered, tells our story, and sheds our tears to free us from the past. The Sufi poet Ghalib invites the storm clouds to weep themselves clear to the end, so that the sky can once again be spacious and clear. Whether in grief, anger, wanting, or restlessness, we can see that much of the work with the contractions of the heart is the work of our unfinished business. We encounter the forces and situations that have held us closed to ourselves and others. What is conflicted, ungrieved, unfinished shows itself as soon as we become attentive. It is here that we must learn how to work respectfully with the profound forces that govern human life. It is the layers of these energies that create contraction and suffering, and the freeing of them that brings awakening and release. The layers of the mind. As with the body and heart, when we go into the mind, it too reveals contraction. The meditation master Ajahn Buddhadasa describes the modern world as lost in thought. Our modern minds hold layers of doubt, ambition, fear, and belief, 1,000 stories and self-images, past and future, that become our defensive mental structure. We see how often the mind dismisses the present moment in order to get somewhere else, be someone else. Whether we engage in prayer, meditation, or selfless service, we will encounter the repetitive thought, our limiting beliefs that create a small sense of self. Our thinking cup is full, and no more will go in. In our novice years, we were taught to surrender to hours of group practices, chanting, the daily cycle of communal prayer, scripture study, devotion, and service. During these initial months, I saw how often I would get lost in some fantasy or story and not be there at all. I would imagine myself as a great saint, or proving myself to my family, or getting back at those who had slighted me, or worrying about the past, telling a story to myself or someone else about how it could be or might have been. Our Mother Superior chided me that I was lost in my stories instead of being where I was, so much so that I would miss the novitiate. Our entanglement in thoughts and beliefs about ourselves, those around us, and the world makes it impossible to be where we are. It is like the Zen painter who finished a life-size portrait of a tiger on the wall of his dwelling. Returning home lost in thought some days later, he was frightened upon seeing the tiger there, having forgotten it was his own creation. As we undertake to quiet our minds through meditation or prayer, we see how much of our life is governed by these unconscious stories. The shamanic writer Carlos Castaneda puts it this way: you talk to yourself too much. You're not unique in that. Every one of us does. We maintain our world with our inner dialogue. A man or woman of knowledge is aware that the world will change completely as soon as they stop talking to themselves. Through practice, we begin to see the themes of our inner dialogue, which can be ambition or unworthiness, insecurity or hope, self-hatred or self-improvement. The stories reflect our conditioning, personal and cultural. When a group of American psychologists met with the Dalai Lama, he asked what difficulties are most common for Western Buddhist students. One of the most mentioned and strongest was self-hatred. The Dalai Lama's reaction was incredulous, for self-hatred is almost unknown in Tibetan culture. He went around the room asking, "Have you too experienced this self-hate?" Almost everyone said yes. Central to the stories we tell are the fixed beliefs we have about ourselves. It is as if we have been cast into a movie as a depressed person or a beautiful one, as a compromiser or a clown, an angry victim or a fighter whom no one will ever take advantage of again. Because those thoughts and assumptions are so powerful, we live out their energies over and over. These patterns of thought, together with the contractions of body and heart, create a limited sense of self. They are sometimes called the body of fear. And when we live from the body of fear, our life is simply one of habit and reaction. An honorable practice unmasks these stories and releases their limiting beliefs, just as it opens the body and heart. We begin to recognize the patterns of these contractions and to learn that they are not the most fundamental reality. We learn how to step from these old skins, the small sense of self, into the reality of the present. We find ways to allow the body to ease, the heart to soften, and the old stories of the mind to fall away. This is the moment when the dragon skins are seen for what they are, a karmic spell no longer needed, and the prince and princess are revealed in their own tender beings, vulnerable and new. With innocence and openness, we return to the simplicity of direct experience. When we step out of the current of thoughts, letting go of how it was and how it should be, of how we should be, when we let go of all of this, we enter the eternal present. But even this shedding of our skins and the release of identification with thoughts, the opening of the body and heart and mind, is still only a preparation for a deeper journey. The prince and princess have seen one another. Now together, they must face the life and death before them. The Fires of Initiation. I recommend almost dying to everybody. It's character building. You get a much clearer perspective of what's important and what isn't, the preciousness and beauty of life. From astronomer Carl Sagan, after surviving a near-fatal illness. And this from Sant Kashavadas. Go ahead, light your candles, burn your incense and ring your bells and call out to God, but watch out, because God will come, and he will put you on his anvil and fire up his forge and beat you until he turns brass into pure gold. Now it is time to go deeper into the forest. What we've described so far is a preparation. We have started to release the old patterns of holding in the body. We've consciously opened to the deep emotions that underlie and propel much of our experience. We've begun to work with the repetitive patterns and beliefs of the mind. Through this work, we come to find ourselves in a clearing, standing face to face with the sacred ox, hearing its quiet, steady breath. The tasks depicted next in the Zen teachings require us to tame the powerful ox, and then to release both the ox and the self, so that we can come into a unified harmony with the world. To release the full energies of life requires a radical process of transformation, often accompanied by a demanding rite of initiation. In spiritual practice, initiation is no simple ceremony. It's the passage through a difficult task by which our heart is matured. In undertaking the trials and hardships of a period of initiation, We can transform our view of ourselves and the world. We can awaken our spiritual authority and inner knowing, a trust that can carry us in the face of difficulties and death. Initiation forces upon us a shift of identity in which we can transcend our small sense of self, release what is called the body of fear, and awaken an undying wisdom, love, and fearlessness. Initiation's transforming process is not always outwardly obvious. Some experience it as a slow spiral, steadily deepening, repetitive remaking of inner being. The heart gradually deepens in knowing, compassion, and trust through the 100,000 repeated practices and heartfelt sincerity of a regular spiritual discipline over and over. The Buddha likened this process to the ocean floor, which descends little by little to the depths of the sea. The teacher Dainan Katagiri Roshi was once asked by his Zen students about the beautiful faith and warmth he radiated. "This is what we want to learn from you. How do we learn that?" The master answered, "When people see me today, they don't see the years I spent just being with my teacher." He described how he practiced year after year, living simply, hearing the same teachings over and over again, sitting every morning no matter what, doing the rituals of the temple. This is the slow way of initiation, putting yourself over and over into the condition of attention and respect, baking yourself in the oven repeatedly until your whole being is cooked, matured, transformed. But more commonly, initiation entails an intense, radical, and rapid change. Such a transformation often takes the archetypal shape of a rite of passage. A rite of passage can be described as a forced journey through a rocky canyon so narrow you can't take any baggage with you, a rebirth in which you must leave your old life behind. It involves great risk, sometimes a brush with death, for only then can the seeker discover fearlessness and find that within himself or herself which is beyond death. Sometimes initiation comes spontaneously. A great loss, crisis, or illness, tended wisely, will cause our hearts to grow. At other times, we may require a more deliberately created initiation. The longing for initiation is universal, and for modern youth it is a desperate need. When nothing is offered in the way of a spiritual initiation to prove one's entry into the world of men and women, initiation happens instead in the road or the street, in cars at high speeds, with drugs, with dangerous sex, with weapons. However troubling, this behavior is rooted in a fundamental truth, a need to grow. One of the great motivations for seeking initiation, as well as one of its tools, is a growing awareness of the limitations of time and awareness of death. One American Tibetan Lama told me, "My parents died when I was only 17 and 18. The reality of death came as a huge, abrupt shock, and it took a long time to work through the grief. With my parents gone, I felt like nothing stood between me and death anymore. This realization forced me to spiritual practice. It's amazing that we don't realize the imminence of our death." Carlos Castaneda's shamanic guide Don Juan recommends taking death as an advisor. Death is our eternal companion. It is always to our left, at an arm's length. It has always been watching you, and it always will until the day it taps you. The thing to do when you're impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just catch the feeling that your companion is there watching you. If we are spiritually committed, we must face our fears of death while we are alive. In Christian mystical practice, this is reliving the mystery of crucifixion and resurrection. In Buddhist meditation, it is learning to die before death. Since death will take us anyway, why live our life in fear? Why not die to our old ways and be free to live?
This concludes tape one of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with tape two.